Well, welcome to the third Agricultural and Applied Economics Association Extension Section webinar presentation, intended to assist agricultural professionals meet the challenges in today's agriculture. Today's webinar is entitled Land Leases, Share, Cash, and Flexible Arrangements in Changing Times. This webinar is being brought to you by the AAEA Extension Section with the able assistance of the Western Extension Committee Ag and Uncertain Times team using technology provided by Montana State University. I'm John Hewlett, Ranch and Farm Management Specialist at the University of Wyoming and Western Region Representative to the Extension Section. It is indeed an honor to serve as host for today's webinar, but I'm only able to do so through the help and assistance of many others on our team working behind the scenes to make these webinars possible. Today's speakers include Dr. Kevin Duvetter from Kansas State University, Dr. William Edwards from Iowa State University, and Dr. Ray Massey from the University of Missouri Commercial Agriculture Program. I'll provide a more in-depth introduction to each of our speakers as we begin each of their presentations. As we proceed, please enter any questions you may have for the presenters in the chat window found at the lower left of your screen. Working with our behind-the-scenes team, I will then put the questions to our presenters. Please use the chat window to either enter questions or to report technical problems. As we all know, computers are a wonderful mechanism that can help overcome distances and solve problems, making webinars like this a reality. However, that same technology can also cause problems. If you experience difficulties, do not hesitate to contact our team for assistance. The Extension Section is just one of over 15 sections of the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association. AAEA sections are subgroups formed by AAEA members with common interests. These AAEA sections are intended to promote networking through a variety of different activities, including pre- and post-conference workshops and track sessions at the annual meeting, email discussion listservs, as well as other unique programs such as today's webinar. If you are not a member of the AAEA or the Extension Section, we invite you to join by following the URLs on your screen, which we'll also make available at the closing of this webinar. If you're having trouble reading the screen at any point in today's webinar, you may want to try the full screen button in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. This button switches between the view you see now and a view where the presentation slides cover the entire screen, making smaller text somewhat easier to read. Please note that while in the full screen mode, you will be unable to see the chat window. Simply press the button again to reveal the chat window and enter any questions you might have. In order to better understand our audience participating in today's webinar, we have a couple of brief questions we would like to ask of all of you who are logged in today. The first question is to describe yourself in terms of your primary occupation, whether you're an agricultural producer, an extension educator, maybe involved in banking or agribusiness, if you're a commodity organization employee or some other description. You can check more than one choice here to make sure that you cover all the choices that would apply to your situation. If you wouldn't mind taking a minute to fill that out, we'd appreciate your input on just what kind of organizations you represent. The next question is asking where it is that your place of business is located, which region of the U.S., whether it's the Northeast, Southeast, Western U.S., Pacific Islands possibly, or even international. Only one vote would be necessary on this question, so I appreciate your input on that. Okay, our third question is whether or not you are currently a member of the AAEA Extension Section. Simple choice here of yes or no. Get a feel for how many of you may be a member. Again, we'd encourage you to consider applying, and we'll put that URL up on the screen a little later. Fourth question, asking, including yourself, how many individuals in total are participating on the webinar at your location? We have a number of choices. It gives us a feel for just how many individuals may be participating, whether it be one to two to five or more, up to more than 20 possible there to choose from. Again, just to get a feel for how many total people are participating in today's webinar. Okay, well, thank you for your responses on that. Our first presenter today will be Dr. Kevin Duvetter, who is a professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State University. His specialty is farm management and marketing. He focuses much of his attention on leasing and buying land, machinery costs, crop and livestock production economics, marketing, and technology adoption. As a researcher and extension agricultural economist, Duvetter has authored numerous publications and producer decision tools and was instrumental in the development and implementation of the AgEcon MAST education program and the agmanager.info website. Kevin grew up on a diversified crop and livestock farm in northwest North Dakota and holds BS, MS, and PhD degrees in agricultural economics from North Dakota State University, Iowa State University, and Kansas State University, respectively. Dr. Duvetter joins us today for the third AAEA Extension Section webinar to present general trends and issues related to leasing land. With that, Dr. Duvetter, I will turn it over to you, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's a real pleasure to be here today. Just one quick little follow-up on your introduction. I have been working at Kansas State University now for 25-plus years, and as you alluded to, this topic is something we deal with tremendously on a day-to-day basis. I'm guessing that most everyone on the audience deals with it as well. But I point that out because some of my perspectives obviously will have a Kansas slant, but I also suspect that that's very similar in most regions across the U.S. Just real quick, and I'm not going to get into a lot of detail, the different types of leases. I believe William will spend a little bit more time on some of these. But when we think about the types of leases on cropland, in my conversation, we'll talk about cropland specifically. We've got a traditional crop share lease where we share the crop, the income. Typically, we would also share some expenses, things like fertilizer, maybe herbicides. In Kansas, we've also had some interest in what we call a net share rent, where we are sharing the income and the crop. So the landowner takes an ownership in the grain, therefore they have to market grain, but there's no input shared. This came about because some landowners didn't mind sharing risk, but they didn't like to pay bills. So literally they will take a smaller share of the crop in exchange for no inputs. And then obviously we have things like fixed cash rent, where the landowner receives a cash payment in exchange for the use of the land. We also have what I'm going to call more hybrid type leases or flexible leases. This is what William will spend a lot more time on. So I'm not going to go into any detail on that other than to say there's a lot of different ways of doing these. This particular slide shows some data from a number of states. On the left, we've got some information from the University of Illinois, or from Illinois, I should say, specifically. Then on the right, there's some information from Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma. And if you just sat and looked at that graph, really the main thing to come across is that as a general rule, what we tend to see is that the Corn Belt probably has a higher percentage of their land cash rented as opposed to crop share. I think that makes a lot of sense that traditionally the drier regions of the High Plains have had more production risk, and therefore landowners oftentimes were asked to share in some of that risk, and that was done through a crop share rent. But the other thing is, and you can't really see that from this graph, but from other data, there's clearly a trend towards more cash rent most everywhere. Just that in states like Kansas, we're lagging behind maybe the Corn Belt, but we clearly are moving to more and more cash rent. And I always ask people, you know, why is that happening? Well, there's a host of reasons. Some of those reasons are driven by landowners. Some of those are driven by tenants. But the point is we're moving to more and more cash rents. The other thing that's becoming more obvious is we're using more of these non-traditional leases, the flexible rents, and that's why we're going to specifically spend some more time on that in this webinar. Another, just some background data. This is some information from Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma that talks about how long land tends to be rented to the same tenant. And I think a lot of people recognize this, that producers tend to lease land from the same landowner for a relatively long time. We know that long-term relationships can be both good and bad. They're good because that allows tenants to make long-term decisions on things like conservation, whether it's tiling, whether it's terraces. It also helps them to do long-term things with regards to nutrient management. On the other hand, I would argue that long-term relationships can be bad because we get very complacent. We tend to just do things the way we've always done them. We all know that agriculture has changed considerably in the last 5 years, and therefore it might be that our historical relationship needs to be changed or modified as well. So how is it that we come up with the terms of a lease? Whether we're talking about a crop share rent or whether we're talking about cash lease, how exactly do we come up with that number or that equitable share? Well, we in Extension and as educators, we get asked that all the time. But the answer is we really don't set rates. It's the market that does that. It's landowners that have land, their supply. It's producers that have farm equipment that want to rent that land, that's demand. And where those two parties come together in negotiations, that's what ultimately sets rates. So it's the market that sets these rates. So let's just look at a couple examples of markets. And I realize this graphic has a lot of numbers, and that's not the point, that there's you have to read the numbers. But USDA NAS surveys cash rent information at the county level, I believe in most every state now, that began in 2009, and they provide an estimate of what the market is. Some problems with that, though, is that an average number for a county can be very misleading for a number of reasons. One is we all know that land is not all equal. Even though we're now at a county level, there still can be a tremendous amount of variation in the quality of land from one area of the county to another. We also know that not all relationships are equal. Sometimes land is rented for below market rates because someone's trying to help somebody else get started in farming. And we don't know that information when we just see an average. And then finally, we don't know the terms of the lease. Has this lease been going on for the last 10 years? Was there a bonus paid that was not reported? Here's another slide from Illinois that basically backs up that last one. And this one shows, like I said, once again, data from Illinois. It says how much variation there is in the rent in a county compared to the county average. And what you can see is we can see that in Illinois that in some cases about 10% of the time, the cash rent in that county might be $60 to $100 or more than $100 more than the average. And likewise, 10% of the time, it might be $6 less. Tremendous amount of variability. So once again, an average number is going to be very misleading because it doesn't tell us the whole story. Some of the conclusions that Gary Schnitke at the University of Illinois had in that paper was he said, part of this is due to land quality differences. And I think we would all agree that that variability is due to quality differences in land. But he also pointed out that a big portion of that's due to relationships, something I alluded to earlier. And as another comment was that landowners and tenants are generally aware of differences that exist, and this is consistent with what they want. I'm not sure that's always the case, or at least not in my experiences in Kansas. I would argue that what we observe many times in Kansas is that there's large differences, but oftentimes the landowner might not be aware that they might be being paid way less than the average. Regardless, the implications are that an average cash rent is not a very good indication of what it takes necessarily to rent that next piece of ground. It also says that sometimes those numbers we hear is not a good indication of what's an average in the area as well. So reiterate that averages have some value, but they have very little value in determining what a particular parcel of ground should rent for. So if that's the case, we've got these market established rates, but they're not really doing a very good job. What exactly should we do? Well, one of the approaches we take in Kansas, and I think people do in other places as well, is that we can look at what an equitable crop share might be and start using that as a point for what might be a reasonable cash rent. When we talk about an equitable lease, and what we're really talking about is that we believe both parties, landowner and tenant, really are in this to maximize profits. And we know that's not always true. Clearly, there's cases where people have other motives, and that's okay. but we're using the assumption that that is what they're looking at. We also point out that on average in the long run, economic profits are expected to equal zero. It also should factor in opportunity costs, which basically says it really doesn't matter if we've got depth on that land or not, if we're highly leveraged on our machinery or not, things of that nature. And then finally, we should be accounting for whether or not this is crop share, cash rent with regards to risk, and we'll talk about that in a little bit here. Well, this is 20 years of data from Northwest Kansas, our enterprise analysis with our Kansas Farm Management Association. And you can see that on average, we seldom cover total costs. So in the previous slide, I said, on average, in the long run, profits equal zero. This would actually suggest that maybe on average in the long run, they might even be below zero. Clearly, the last 5 years, they've been significantly above zero for most crops, on average. And that suggests to me that we might be seeing some adjustments going forward. Likely those adjustments will be in our land rental rates. That's not a Kansas unique scenario. This is similar data for corn and soybeans in Illinois, and the same kind of pattern holds true. The first 15 years out of this 20-year time period, on average, a very negative margin. In other words, total costs were actually negative, or total returns above total costs were actually negative. The last 5 years have averaged quite well. But once again, suggesting that we probably will continue to see an adjustment, and in many cases, that adjustment could be higher rents. Well, I mentioned the difference in risk, and we do know that a producer that's cash renting land has more risk than a producer who's renting land on a crop share basis. That's because regardless of what the yields are, regardless of what the market's at, they're committed to a cash rental payment. Whereas with crop share, the landowner, by definition, is sharing in some of that risk. So what that really says is a producer should expect, on average, to make more money when they rent land on a cash basis in exchange for the risk they're taking. Likewise, a landowner should actually expect to make less money with a cash rent than a crop share because they have less risk. The big question is how much less? Well, I posed that question to a number of landowner and tenants that were attending our meeting in the winter. And out of 202 people 2 years ago, this was the response. I gave them clicker questions. And you can see that about 82% of the people said a landowner should make somewhere between 0 and 15% less when they go to cash rent compared to what they would have made with crop share. I asked the same question this past winter. The only difference was is I widened out the scale thinking that maybe I had biased people. And you can see that we still have about 82% suggesting somewhere between 0 to 20%. But you'll notice in both cases, there's a number of people that said it should be about the same amount. So that suggests to me that there's a huge difference in the risk aversiveness of our tenants. Some feel they should pay a lot less. Others say it's not that big a deal, I'd pay the same amount. So that's what's going to dictate what drives some of the local rents. This is only 2 years of data. 2 years of data is probably not long enough to make strong, bold statements. But at Illinois, we actually saw that landowners that received cash rent made more money than those that were getting a crop share. Remember, from a landowner's perspective, we would expect them to make less, but not in this case, they weren't making less, they actually were making more. But I would remind you, it's only 2 years, and that might be what's driving that. Well, why might that be the case? Why is it that if we move from crop share to cash rent, that we actually won't see rents go down, we might even see them go up? Well, as farms get larger and larger, and I think that's occurring in many areas of the country, typical producers dealing with a lot of landowners, it costs a lot of time and management effort to manage a lot of crop share leases. I have to keep track of whose bushels went where, who's sharing which inputs. Going to cash rent makes it much easier to manage, therefore the tenant has lower costs. They also have more production flexibility. In the state of Kansas, this summer I suspect we'll see a lot of double crop soybeans following wheat if we've got some decent moisture. much easier to know how to handle that with cash rent versus crop share. Also, with crop insurance in this day and age, we can manage some of that production and marketing risk relative to what we could have in the past. And therefore, some tenants say, it's okay if I don't share this like I did conventionally because I can manage that risk myself with some of the tools we've got. Also, for our more progressive, or I guess I should say aggressive producers that are really trying to expand, we do know that expansion is easier to happen with cash rent because it's a more competitive market. I can aggressively bid up rents. Obviously, neighbors don't like that, but that's just the reality of how it oftentimes happens. Also could do it with timing. So the reality is there's a lot of reasons why when we go from crop share to cash rent, landowners might actually see their rents stay very stable and possibly even go up. Well, another question I asked at these meetings this last winter, a kind of a clicker question if you want, was I like to ask the landowners and tenants, reminding you that my audience tends to be pretty well mixed. I said, whose responsibility is it to see that a landowner's cash rental rate is fair and equitable given what's going on in the market? In other words, is it the landowner's job to know, or is it really the tenant's job to tell them? So I asked that question, and based on about 160 people that answered this question, you can see it was fairly well split. Turns out, coincidentally, my audience was fairly well split, so I can't make a bold statement. I do suspect that the landowners were saying it was the tenant's job, and I think the tenants were saying it was the landowner's job. But what I like to remind people is it's everybody's job. Landowners, it's your job to know what your land is worth. So landowners need to take it upon themselves to know what's fair and equitable. On the other hand, I would also argue, and I argue very hard at these meetings, that the tenants have a responsibility too because they often have way more information. Many times our landowners are absentee. They live out of date. They don't know what's going on locally, and they rely very heavily on their tenant to share information with them. So in that case, I would argue that the tenants have a responsibility to also help the landowner understand what the land is worth. Now, I've had some tenants tell me, well, it's really not my job to tell my landowner what their land is worth. And I remind them that, well, there is a solution to that. A solution is the landowner can take their land and put it on a cash rent auction. And I've got a slide here that's some information from an auction that happened in Iowa this year. And the reason I share this is because it got a lot of people's attention. This information got on the email, you know, and was sent around a lot. And it was some very, very high numbers. And if you compare that with what the Iowa State cash rent survey would suggest, an average from the auction of almost $500 an acre is not quite double, but it's significantly above the averages for those regions. So my point of this is not saying that you'll get a lot more money with cash rent auctions. My point of it is to say this is one way landowners might try to find out what their land is really worth. Similar example in Kansas. Previous year, so instead of this spring, this was actually in January of 2011, Northwest Kansas, land brought an average cash rent of $126. The NAF data for those areas, about $38. So the question is what is the market? Well, this reinforces what I was saying before. I don't believe some of our survey numbers reflect the market very well. On the other hand, I'm also going to say, I'm not going to suggest that that cash rent auction reflects the market for all land in that area either. But I put this out as a reminder that if you as a tenant don't want to share information with your landowner, we somewhat might be forcing them into going this direction of these cash rent auctions. I asked a clicker question, and I only did this for, I think, one or two meetings toward the end of the season. I wish I would have thought of asking this question a lot earlier, but it really was that auction up in Iowa that got a lot of people thinking about cash rent auctions. So I asked this clicker question. I said, whether you participated in them or not, what's your opinion of cash rent auctions? And I basically gave the choices of I love them all the way to I hate them. And you can see that nobody, and once again, this tends to be mixed crowds, about half landowners, about half tenants. Nobody said they really love them. About 9% said, oh, they're okay. But clearly, the majority of people said, we really don't like them. And I immediately tell people that's my opinion of them as well. I would prefer we don't move in this direction for a number of reasons. I'm not sure they're always the same reasons as what the people in the audience might be thinking. This happens to be a slide that showed there's a story done out about the Iowa cash rent auction, and just pull out one paragraph from that story that said there's no secrets. Farmland tenants generally dislike public lease auctions for two big reasons. One is they remove the traditional personal relationship bond between the owner and tenant and reduce it to a numbers game. And two, it publicizes actual cash rents so all the landlords can compare their leases. If I had to guess, I think number one is what's going on in many cases, but not for the right reasons. If I'm paying my landowner a fair and equitable rent given the current market conditions, I would argue we'll have a very good, strong relationship. I think the relationship it destroys is all of a sudden my landowner might realize how much I was being underpaid for many years, and in that case, it does destroy that relationship. But I also am concerned about the second point, because we do know sometimes that someone hears a number and they think that's the right number for everyone in the area, and we know not all land is equal, and that is a scary thing about auctions is we'll somehow believe that's the appropriate number for all land, and that clearly would not be the case. So just to kind of wrap this first session up, the trend has been away from crop share leases. It's moving away fairly rapidly in Kansas. A lot of states have already moved much faster away from it. We'll continue to see more and more cash rent. I think that's going to increase the importance of communication for tenants. We know that when you go to cash rent, you actually have less communication required, but I would argue that you have to communicate more because that's why some of these relationships go sour. We just aren't talking to each other. I think we'll see an increased number of these flexible type leases that William's going to talk about, but at the same time, they might become complicated and we might not see a rapid adoption of them. Average rents reported in many of our surveys, I would argue, have very limited value for setting rates of individual parcels for a number of reasons, as we've talked about. They can possibly be used to get some general trends over time. The use of cash rent auctions will occur more often in the future if tenants aren't proactive in sharing information with their landowners. If I'm sharing information with my landowner, they have really no reason to put their land up for auction unless they're just trying to get the top dollar. I think they put it up for auction because they really don't know what it's worth, and I'm not sharing a lot of information with them. So we might see more of it. If tenants are proactive, I don't think we would necessarily have to see a lot more auctions. And then the last thing I would argue, and I didn't really spend any time on this, but in my experiences, 25 years of doing this, when we have problems with leases, I would argue it many times comes down to we treated things in a non-business-like case. And that's often family situations, but the more we treat the lease business-like, I think the less problems we'll have. With that, I've got a slide in here that'll point out a few resources, but I think we can see this slide later. So, John, at that point, that's the end of my slides.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Dubetter, for your valuable insights and observations on the general trends and issues related to leasing land. But we'll move now to ask a couple of questions of Dr. Dubetter, given his presentation topic. First one is, given your work with farm managers and leases around the region which you have responsibility for, would you describe which type of lease arrangement is the fairer, cash leases or crop share, and why, in your estimation?
It's a good question. In my opinion, and once again, I said, keep in mind this is coming heavily from my Kansas perspective, I would no question say that the crop share is a fairer lease. And now, a number of my economist colleagues would be probably criticizing me for using the word fair, because it's very hard to define the word fair, kind of in the eye of the beholder. But by that, I mean, crop share leases, the beauty of them is they kind of adjust with the market. Cash rents, the reason I would argue they're not as fair is because they can become very out of whack, if you want, and we oftentimes don't make adjustments quick enough. Now, if I have a cash lease and I'm adjusting it on a regular basis, it can be every bit as fair as a crop share lease. I would only argue it's less fair because sometimes we get complacent and we don't make adjustments as needed, and the crop share lease kind of takes care of that.
Okay, thank you for that. We do have another question that's come in from the audience wondering what, if any, and again, in your experience in working with people putting these together, but what, if any, agreements or arrangements are being made where people are trying to account for large changes in commodity prices within the lease arrangement?
That's probably a better question for William after he finishes his, because his presentation will be talking about flex rents, and that's exactly what that whole the purpose of flex rents are. So I think we'll kind of leave that on hold, and I think that might become more clear as William gives his presentation.
Okay, and so I'll ask one other question then, not to let you off the hook here. Do many of the operators you work with have developed formal written lease agreements, or in your estimation, should they? And I'm kind of wondering also whether or not you think that when those types of written arrangements are put together that they end up in a more equitable situation whereby both parties have basically had to consider what the terms are and kind of who's contributing what.
Well, first of all, whenever we've done some surveys and I haven't shown all the clicker question data, we clearly see that still the majority of people probably don't have written leases. And in a lot of cases, I think a lot of states have seen similar data. We do know it's changing over time. We have more people that have written leases today. One of the things why I push written leases is probably not for the same reason some people might think. I'm not pushing written leases because, you know, this is a legal contract and we absolutely have to have it. I think there's a lot of value in having good, strong relationships with our tenant, and sometimes a handshake is very sound. The reason I want written leases is because it's just one more communication tool. It's making sure all parties understand what's going on. So exactly what you just said is I think it'll lead to having a more fair and equitable lease because we all understand things a little better when it's in print and it's more transparent. But I would still argue that the majority of our leases are still, in many cases in Kansas, not written, but it is increasing, or it's trending in that direction.
Okay, thank you for that set of insights. There are a number of other questions that we will try to get to as we have a panel discussion at the close of this webinar session in total. Dr. Edwards is a professor of economics at Iowa State University. He specializes in extension and classroom education in farm management topics, including lease arrangements, risk management, machinery economics, farm accounting, and personnel management. He is the co-author of the textbook Farm Management and is a frequent contributor to the Ag Decision Maker website from ISU. He's also a former president of the AAEA Extension Section. Dr. Edwards joins us today to present Flexible Farm Leases and Cash Rent Surveys. Thank you for taking time to join us today, Dr. Edwards. I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, John. And Kevin has done a very good job of laying out some of the different choices among types of farm leases. As he mentioned, and I think in many of our states, we do see a trend towards more cash rent leases and away from crop share leases. But one of the major problems that we always find with cash rents is that we end up having to set the rent in advance, maybe a year or more before the actual yields and prices are known, depending on the precise termination dates and laws in every state. This works okay when prices and yields are somewhat stable, but in periods of very volatile prices or yield problems, the rent that's set may not be appropriate once the actual crop is harvested and sold. So one of the solutions that has been advanced and that we are talking about a lot is a flexible lease contract. The advantages of a flexible lease contract is that we are sharing risk and profit, somewhat like we do under a crop share lease. But it is a cash rent, which adjusts automatically as the economic returns to the land change, and it is in close correlation with the tenant's ability to pay from year to year. It also avoids that awkward, stressful moment when the tenant and the landlord get together each year and talk about the rent for next year. Nobody really likes those conversations. The flexible cash rent involves a formula which automatically computes that rent each year. However, unlike a crop share lease, the owner does not have to pay any input costs and is not involved in grain marketing, so for many landowners that removes some of these elements that they dislike about a crop share lease. Flexible rents are not for everyone, though. Certainly not all landowners are in a position to bear risk, financial risk. They may desire to have a fixed and known income in advance. Whatever formula we come up with for determining the rent adds another layer of complexity to the agreement. And for many people, more complexity in their life is not what they're looking for. It requires some trust on the part of the tenant and the landlord, particularly when the tenant must supply information regarding the lease agreement, which the landlord really has no way of verifying independently. For the tenant's standpoint, the selling price, if that is incorporated into the flexible rent formula, may still not be the one that the tenant actually receives when selling the crop. So there is still some variability there between the fixed rent price and the actual selling price. And some tenants feel that extra yields or higher than average yields are at least partly due to their superior management ability, and that they should not be having to pay a higher rent simply because they are able to get higher yields than the next tenant. So there are some drawbacks as well as some advantages to these leases. There are several different types of flexible leases. We're going to go through five different variations on these, but I know that in various regions and states there are some other variations that work well as also. The first one we'll look at is based simply on a fixed number of bushels and the value of those bushels from year to year. An example would be the cash rent will be equal to the value of 10 bushels of wheat each year. So if the actual price turns out to be $4.50 a bushel at the end of the year, the rent is $45. So in this way, we're sharing price risk. If the price goes up or down, the rent goes up or down automatically. We're not sharing any yield or production risk, though. So these types of variable leases work best in areas where yield is fairly stable and there is not a lot of production volatility to worry about. The other extreme to this would be basing the rent on a fixed price per bushel of yield. So, for example, the rent may be set equal to $1.50 per bushel of corn. If the actual corn yield is 172 bushels per acre, the rent is $258 per acre. A very straightforward type of lease. We're sharing yield risk. The rent goes up and down directly in proportion to the yield each year. Again, we're not sharing any price risk. So this may work best in areas or for commodities where the price risk is minimal. It also works for a producer for whom price risk is really irrelevant. For example, a producer who feeds all of the crop through livestock and really is not affected by the market price variability from year to year. One of the biggest problems is that in many areas, price and yield are negatively correlated, so that we have a high yield one year, we may have a low price or vice versa. So flexing the rent only on price or only on yield does not necessarily reflect the economic returns to that year or the tenant's ability to pay. So we really recommend that most flexible lease formulas incorporate both price and yield into the formula for setting the rent. One approach to this is simply flexing the rent based on gross income, price times yield, and that does tie then to the tenant's ability to pay each year. We'll take an example. We'll say that the cash rent is equal to 30% of the gross income each year from a corn crop. So if our actual yield is 160 bushels and the price at harvest is $5 per bushel, 160 times $5 is $800 per acre gross. 30% of that is $240 per acre. In another year, the price might rise to $6.50. We can hope for that. With the same yield, the rent would automatically increase to $312 per acre that year. Now, we'll talk a little bit later about actually setting some of these parameters, because the principles are easy. The devil, of course, is in the details. What percentage of gross should we use? We have gone back in Iowa, at least, and looked at cash rents as a percent of gross income over the last decade. We did this simply by taking the state average yield for corn and soybeans each year and the state average cash price during harvest. We actually took the October, November, and December cash prices, and then based on an average cash rent for our from our surveys that we do each year, we simply compute rent as a percentage of gross income. Now, the interesting thing is that the first 5 years of the past decade, those numbers were considerably higher than they have been in the last few years. And I think part of this is that rents have been a little bit slow to adjust to the higher gross incomes that we have seen in corn and soybean production. But during the last 5 years, our rents have averaged around 35% of gross for soybeans and around 24% for corn. So that is at least a starting point based on market, the relative market conditions in recent years. Another possibility is if you're in a region that has had net share rents, as Kevin described, simply using the same percent share that is traditional for a net share rent, under which the landlord is not paying any input costs, would be another logical starting point for rent as a percent of gross income. A variation on this is what we would call base rent plus a bonus. In this variation, we set a base rent or a minimum rent. We set a minimum or base gross revenue, and then we share in any gross revenue above that base. So, for example, if the rent is set at $200 per acre plus half of the gross income in excess of $500 per acre. So we're actually splitting half of the gross income. The theory being is that some years really there are what we would call pure profits, just in excess of normal profits based on market conditions in that year. So with our example, if using soybeans, if the actual price was $12.50 per bushel, the actual yield is $52, 52 bushels per acre, that would give us a gross income of $650 per acre. Well, that's $150 over our base gross revenue, and so half of that would give us a bonus of $75 per acre. We simply add that to the base rent. Total rent that year is $275 per acre. In some cases, the base rent may be payable in advance at the beginning of the lease, and the bonus is payable, of course, at the end of the crop year. Now, how do we set base rents and base revenues? Excellent question. We could go back to, quote, old rent levels, which is anything before 2011 seems to be the old regime, and looking at typical gross revenues before rents started to increase rapidly. Use that as a starting point. Another variation that some of our more astute landlords and tenants are looking at is looking at cost of production. And we haven't talked about cost risk, but certainly most tenants have had some cost of production risk. We've had some fluctuations in fertilizer costs. And so they are looking at setting the base revenue equal to their cost of production, including the base rent in that cost of production. So we include, of course, seed, fertilizer, chemicals, as well as machinery and labor costs. We may refer to custom rates to value those resources. Add in the base rent, and so the tenant gets enough gross income to cover all of those costs, and then anything above that is shared in some percentage between the tenant and the landlord. Another variation is simply use your state extension service budgets, and I think all of us have those budgets available in most regions. Okay, the final example would be using an index. Again, we set a base rent of $200 and a base price and yield of $10 per bushel and 45 bushels per acre. This may be what we expect conditions to be when we sign the lease. And then if prices or yield are different than those, we simply divide the actual price or yield by the expected price or yield, which gives us a percentage. That could be, of course, a positive or a negative adjustment to the base rent. In this example, $200 times $12 over 10 times 40 bushels over 44 would end up with a rent of $218 per acre. And of course, in many cases, an above average price may be offset by a below average yield or vice versa. This approach would give us pretty similar results to the first example using simply a percentage of the gross revenue. Okay, now some of the nitty-gritty. How do we determine the actual yield? A number of ways. If the crop is all sold, scale tickets can give us an exact measurement. These would need to be corrected to a standard moisture level. Most tenants have combine yield monitors now, where we may be able to track the actual yield in the field or by the use of weigh wagons. If it's the crop is placed in storage, we may be able to look at storage bin capacities and estimate the volume there. If the crop is sold later than harvest, we may not want to wait that long, so we may have to use one of these other methods. One approach that seems to have worked well and takes some of the trust out of the equation is simply using crop insurance data. If the crop is insured, using the bushels that the tenant turns in for crop insurance purposes. But certainly there is some trust involved here, and I guess if that is really an issue between the tenant and the landlord, a flexible lease probably is not really appropriate for that relationship. Some tenants feel that higher than average yields are at least partly due to their management ability. It may not be due all to productivity or weather, and that they should not have to pay higher rent because they are able to get higher yields than the neighboring tenant. In that case, we may want to use the county average yield in the equation rather than the actual farm yield. That has the advantage of being verifiable by the landlord. It's a third-hand number. Unfortunately, it's not available immediately after harvest. We may have to wait several months before we know what that county average yield is. But in a long-term leasing agreement, that may not be a problem. Okay, the price side of the equation, traditionally we've said, well, take an average price at one of the nearest elevators or processors, a purchasing point at several days during the harvest season, average them together. That worked pretty well until we had a season where the price went up very sharply during harvest, and a lot of tenants had pre-sold crop at a lower price, but their rent was then based on a higher price than they actually received. So now we have people that are looking at extending that price period, starting maybe in March or April, and incorporating pre-harvest pricing opportunities into that average price as well. We don't recommend using prices after harvest. Generally, there's some storage return incorporated into those post-harvest prices. And unless the owner is providing storage and not being reimbursed any other way for that storage, we feel that that storage return really belongs to the tenant. A couple of other possibilities: we could use the FSA posted county price. We could also use the crop insurance harvest price. That's a futures price, so we'd really want to correct that for the basis difference between that and a cash price. Another question that comes up: should we include crop insurance payments in gross income if we're basing the rent on gross income? I think the question that goes along with that is: the landowner bearing any of the downside risk? If there's a minimum rent in the formula, then the landowner maybe does not have a lot of downside risk. So probably the crop insurance should simply be a matter of the tenant's own risk management strategy. If there is no downside risk, though, this is a way for the landowner to basically insure the rent is by participating at least indirectly in the crop insurance benefits, but also the costs. So if we include indemnity payments in gross income, we should make that a net payment. In other words, deduct the premiums from the gross. And even in years where there is no indemnity payment, we should also deduct those premiums from the gross income, so that in effect, the landowner is sharing in the insurance cost from year to year. So, that's a fine point, but it does come up sometimes with these agreements. Government payments are another problem. Should they be included? Hopefully they'll go away pretty soon and we won't have to answer that question anymore. Payments that are based as a shallow revenue guarantee, for example, probably could be treated very much as crop insurance payments are. Flexible farm leases definitely need to be in writing. We need to give some examples, show what happens under several different price and yield scenarios so that both parties understand exactly how the process works and how the rent will be determined. We do have a file on our Ag Decision Maker website that gives 30 or 40 actual flexible cash lease examples that we've collected over the years from our surveys and give people an idea of the range of possibilities. Now, a slightly different topic is cash rent surveys. Simply, many of us are in the business of helping tenants and landlords determine what is a quote, fair cash rent. Well, what is the market? Cash rent, farmland, comes very close to the classic definition of a free market. There are no regulations based on how much rent that we can charge or pay. But one of the characteristics of a free market is that both buyer and seller have information, complete information. And I think that's where our role as educators can come in. Some sources: National Ag Statistics Service surveys. Many universities do their own surveys. Some states, such as Illinois and Minnesota, look at Farm Business Association data to see what rents have actually been in the past year. The NAS surveys, they do survey farm operators. They do provide county-based numbers. They provide only an average. As Kevin mentioned, there's no indication of variability or distribution. I've seen their questionnaire. They simply ask for total dollars paid in rent and the number of acres rented by cash rent. They do divide it between dry land, cropland, irrigated cropland, and pasture. So we do have three different types, and they do ask a question about whether the land is rented from relatives. So presumably they exclude any observations that might be affected by family relationships. Iowa State does a university survey each year. Developing a survey list is a very difficult thing. We send questionnaires to the entire membership list of our Farm Manager Society. They're very cooperative. We send surveys to everyone on our Ag Bankers mailing list. Again, good cooperation from the Iowa Bankers Association. We rely on Extension County staff and Extension Councils to provide us with names of tenants and landlords. We use registration lists for meetings. One interesting source we found was the Environmental Working Group database, which shows who are the biggest recipients of farm commodity payments in every county and by crop. And you can simply very easily print out a list of the top 20 or 30 recipients in each county, and we just assume that they are also people that are renting considerable amount of farmland. We include them in our survey list. Now, in our survey, we ask for typical rates. We do not survey individual farm rents. We would have to have a much bigger sample size if we did this. But one of the drawbacks is people think we do that anyway, no matter how many times we say we don't. But we ask for typical rental rates for different qualities of cropland, as well as pasture, corn stalks, and hunting rights. Is there bias? We try to sample both sides of the market. Operators, lenders, landowners, professional managers. The only thing we've seen is that professional managers tend to give higher numbers than the other three groups. I think partly because they're certainly going to be more aggressive about renegotiating rents when the market is on an upward trend. They're more familiar with those rents than they are maybe some of the family or some of the long-time leases that do not go through a professional farm manager. We compared our survey results to the NAS results. Our county average rent was higher in all 99 counties than NAS. 13% was the average difference, so probably not too bad. Why is this? What accounts for the difference? Is there some sample bias in the NAS? Well, 2 days ago I was in a conference and that question was put to a NAS official here in the state of Missouri. His answer was, we believe what farmers tell us. Okay, so you can take that for what it's worth. I think another factor is that when rents are trending upwards, we have marginal rents versus average rents. Marginal rents are those farms that are negotiated each year or most recently. Average rents include a lot of rents that have not changed for a number of years. And so in our survey, we try to report average rents, but I think probably our answers are more affected by some of these marginal or the recently negotiated numbers than the NAS survey is. Nevertheless, we still get accused of underreporting rents because the newly negotiated rents are the ones that everyone hears about in the coffee shop and in the nursing homes and other places. So I think we're ready for some questions. John, if you have some questions you'd like to throw this way now, or if not, we'll move on to Ray Massey.
Well, Dr. Edwards, thank you very much for your comments on flexible farm leases and cash rent surveys. We do have a few questions. We'll take a couple now and then leave the rest to the general questions at the end. The first of these questions is, given the current volatility in agriculture, and we're all pretty familiar with the ups and downs both in output prices as well as input prices, do you work with many operators who are attempting to incorporate factors to adjust for both changes in input and output prices in their lease arrangements?
I'd say the vast majority of the flexible leases that we're familiar with incorporate price and yield. Not very many of them incorporate input cost variability. I did give the example of using a base revenue number, which is based on cost of production. And some of our more astute, not only tenants, but landlords realize that cost risk is a very real thing. I think it's still a very small number that try to incorporate that, though.
Okay. And a sort of follow-on to that is, have you developed or are you aware of any kind of software that would allow landowners or tenants to evaluate various alternative lease arrangements?
Well, that's a pretty easy one. I could point them to the Ag Decision Maker website, which is our Iowa State University Farm Management website. We do have a spreadsheet there which allows either a tenant or landlord to input the various parameters of a flexible lease and then produce a 2x2 contingency table showing what the actual rent would be under various price and yield scenarios. And I'm sure there are other states that have similar decision aids available.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for your comments. In the interest of time and to give Dr. Massey the full time to make his presentation, we'll now make a quick change. Our third and final formal presentation for today's webinar will be offered by Dr. Massey, who is an agricultural economist at the University of Missouri with the Commercial Agriculture Program. His specialty is risk management, with an emphasis on the impact of production agriculture in the environment. He has worked on reducing atrazine in water, the management of manure, using weather information to manage land decisions, and educating farmers and policymakers about the environmental sensitivities on their lands. He has a PhD in agricultural economics from Oklahoma State University and was on the faculty of the University of Nebraska before coming to the University of Missouri to work with the Commercial Agriculture Program in 1995. As a personal note, Ray is married with three daughters, and he enjoys woodworking and bicycling. Dr. Massey joins us today to present pasture rental arrangements. So, Dr. Massey, thank you for being with us today, and we look forward to your comments.
Well, thank you, John. And I might just mention right here at the beginning that I'm going to kind of take my presentation based on what's already been said and kind of give pointers in how pasture rental rate may differ or be affected because it's pasture relative to cropland. So some of the stuff that's been said before, I'll just give a slight twist to. Before I go on with these economic objectives, I'd also like to say that the pasture rental rates or rental activities seem to differ the further west you go. Further west, a lot of the pastures are predominantly pasture rental, whereas you get into Missouri and then further east in Missouri, some of this pasture is kind of comes along with cropland, and it's a portion of a rental arrangement that's both pasture and crop. And so there are some differences geographically in what goes on. But economically, the livestock owner is wanting to obtain economic returns to investment and labor. So he's going to be buying cattle. He's going to be providing management, perhaps some feed, his labor. He's wanting to get an economic return to that. The landowner, on the other hand, is wanting to get an acceptable economic return to his land that that he is providing. But the difference between pasture and a cropland here might be the fact that the landowner is trying to maintain a grass stand and maintain grass quality. So there's some growing crop that the landowner is responsible for here. And so the key to success is understanding that the perennial nature of pasture makes pasture rental a long-term concern. Even if the lease is renewed annually, the landowner is perhaps even more concerned with what's happening on a year-to-year basis because that pasture is his. In order to make sure that everything works well, the key is clearly defining the stocking rate. And at this point, I would say that a pasture rent should definitely be written because a written lease will define that stocking rate. And I've got some examples here on this slide of how stocking rate is not clearly understood. The term animal units is used very commonly in the western U.S. Historically, if you ask a lot of old ranch hands, it's a 1,000-pound beef cow with a calf that's less than 3 months of age. But if you ask a new graduate from the university, it is a consumption of 17.6 pounds of dry matter per day. Which one is it? at that point, the definition is not clear, and therefore I think the lease does need to be written as to what exactly is an animal unit. Perhaps the further east you go, it's, in my opinion, perhaps a little more simpler. They just say, what is the number, the size, and the type of the animal, as opposed to trying to define an animal unit. But even if you get the definition of an animal right, and it's clearly understood, the stocking rate issue is still needs to come down to some other definitions, and that is, when is the stocking rate measured? The hope is that the livestock will weigh more at the end of the lease than at the beginning. So are you going to measure the stocking rate at the beginning or at the end? And some would say it at maximum during the lease period. So if there is some adjustments, again, that'd be with the cow-calf activity where the calf is removed, the cow continues to stay on. There is this question of when is the stocking rate measured? And what is the duration of the stocking rights? Is it for a full year? Is the pasture just being leased as a pasture? Or is it for some specified portion of the year where you are just going to be renting it for the spring or the fall or some portion of it? Again, these types of questions and answers are going to be critical to having a lease relationship that is beneficial to both the landowner and the tenant, or at this point, the livestock owner. So they need to be clearly defined and best in writing. Some other factors that will affect lease rates is, like any other real estate transaction, location, location, location. Again, many times the livestock owner is wanting land that's in proximity to his livestock, and so there are opportunities for differences to exist because of proximity to the headquarters or the other land, and also just the quality of the land that changes even within short distances. Water is a key issue. And water is handled differently at different areas of the United States, whether it's access to ponds and streams, which is very common here in Missouri, or whether you've got windmills and in some places actually water delivered out to the cattle. Those are going to affect the lease rates that are going on. Land owner services. In some cases, the landowner is actually the one that would be looking at the cattle on a daily basis, as opposed to the livestock owner coming out daily, making sure that things are going well. If that's the case, the livestock or the landowner needs to recognize that that's a contribution to production and be compensated for that. Frequently in Missouri, though, as an honesty thing here, pasture is frequently considered an incidental part of a crop farm rental. You know, if you rent 100 acres here in Missouri, you might get 80 acres of cropland out of it, and you've got 20 acres of pasture land right next to it. The farmer is most interested in that cropland, and it's at this point that you do need to say, wait a minute, that 20 acres of pasture land also is an important asset. And so how are you going to manage it? What are you going to do with regard to stocking rate, to fencing, and things of that nature? So make sure that it comes up in the discussion of a land rental, even if it's only for crops that the land is being rented. So after that, many of the things that Kevin and William have already talked about are the same with regard to rental rate options. You can rent on a per acre basis. This is perhaps the simplest, because everybody knows how many acres are out there. The drawback of this is that it gives incentive to stock heavily. So if you've clearly defined what the stocking rate is, the duration of the stocking period, that's not a problem. But if that's not clearly defined on a per acre basis, you might be disappointed to find out a year later that your grass has been damaged. Another way is the share of gain basis, which would just be like a crop share. It does require trust in the livestock owner reporting accurately how much gain was obtained. And at the same time, that gives incentive to stock heavily because that livestock owner might just be concerned about a single year worth of gain. So the question is, define very well the stocking rate. There are rental rate options on a per animal unit or a per animal day, and that requires trust in the livestock owner reporting it, but it does reduce the incentive to stock heavily because the heavier that they stock, the more animal units are out there, they'll have to pay for those animal unit days. And so those are the three ways that rental options are typically written. Whenever you're trying to figure out, okay, what is the cost going to be, you'll want to know what your landowner's contribution is and then your livestock owner's contribution. For the most part, the landowner is looking at the ownership cost associated with the land and facilities. So the land is the most important one, but we do encourage people to value the facilities that benefit the livestock producer. If there's some corrals, some barns, some watering systems and things of that nature, those need to be taken into account. But if there are facilities that are not going to be used by the livestock producer, even though the landowner thinks they have value, they may not be giving value to this particular rental agreement and should not be valued. I might mention that the rent-to-value ratio is lower, usually, for pasture rents than for crop rents. So if you're looking at a percentage of the value of your land and trying to estimate a contribution from that, for pasture, it tends to be lower than for croplands. There are some variable costs that landowners sometimes contribute, fertilizer perhaps, labor perhaps. They need to be considered if they are offered. And I just mentioned here that landowners usually compute their cost on a per acre basis. The reason I do that is my next slide shows that the livestock owner usually thinks of things on a per animal basis, and so we've got to get that back together. The livestock owner, though, is looking at their net returns to grazing. They're saying, hey, what was the value or increased value of animals during the grazing period, and what did it cost me as far as purchasing the livestock, any feed, any veterinary medicine, any travel, transportation, things of that nature, so that they get a net return that they can begin to use in their negotiation of a rental rate. Once they get that net return, because they want it on a per acre basis, most likely for rental, they just need to divide that net return by the stocking rate to determine what the per acre rate would be. For determining the lease rate, we can go with the cash rent, where the landowner and the livestock owner negotiate from their respective contributions that they've just figured out, as shown on the last two slides. Go with a share of gain. It may be that they're just splitting the gain and the livestock value. And then there are variable rates, that just like there are with crops, where you increase or decrease the lease rate based on the number of pounds that were gained or based on a market price that was obtained. Again, I really do think that for pasture leases especially, it is critical to put them in writing because of the importance of understanding what the stocking rate is and what the term of the stocking is. It just gives you an opportunity to discuss and to have agreed upon terms. It is a guide to heirs, a documentation for tax purposes, but put it in writing. And I might just mention at this point here that at aglease101.org, we have actual lease forms for pasture and for cash rent of crop and for share rent of crop. So we have quite a few forms and educational activities or educational material for these types of leases that we've been talking about today. And at that, I think I'm going to turn it back to you, John.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Massey, very much for your insights on pasture rental arrangements. I'll have a couple of questions here now for you, and then we'll move to a more general discussion. One of those questions has come in is, much of the forage produced on native rangeland in particular, but also on some croplands that would be used as pasture, is variable due to weather. Is there some way that you've seen people use to account for this type of variability in designing their lease arrangements?
Yeah, there is. As I'd mentioned in one of my slides there, you can do it just like William mentioned on for crop rent. You could say, I expect to have so many pounds of gain in it in this season, and then you would have some ratio of how many pounds of gain actually were obtained versus what was expected, and that percentage or that ratio would change the lease that you have. And that account, that would take into consideration the variable grass or pasture quality just because of weather.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for that insight. Another question is, have you worked with operators, particularly given how volatile conditions are currently for a lot of livestock operators, have you worked with those folks that have tried to incorporate factors to account for changes in input and output prices, or, you know, kind of flex factors like William was discussing as far as their pasture leasing arrangements, and how have they incorporated those?
You know, I'm going to have to answer no, that I have not worked with anybody trying to incorporate that on the livestock side. And it could be where I'm from. In Missouri, the pasture leases tend to be incidental to crop leases. And so they're not getting very complicated. They tend to be on a cash rent or, predominantly on cash rent and without any variation for input prices. Oh, just a second. Kevin Dubeter has worked with them.
I've worked just a limited amount with some of cow-calf producers. And at this point, the flex is entirely the price flex. You know, as William gave an example, and as you just alluded to with the previous question, that's a little bit risky if we don't account for the fact that if it doesn't rain, the production might not be there. But right now, at the moment, what they've done, several people I've worked with, they've established a base cash rent, kind of using a five-year average price for the calves they plan to wean, and then they're flexing based on what prices actually will be this year relative to that five-year average. That has not been used to the extent, I've not worked with anybody that's doing that in a stocker operation, because obviously there we have to account for both the margin, the buy price as well as the sell. But I have worked with some people on cow-calf that are doing it 100% at this point on price.
Okay, well, thank you both for those insights. I think we'll move now to a more general kind of discussion regarding comments that each of you have made at different points along the way. So the first one of those questions is, come in from the audience, is, do you suggest using a crop productivity index as a guide for determining cash rent values?
Well, I think if crop productivity indexes are available, certainly they are a good guide. They are not available in every state, and they aren't the same in every state. But they are a third-hand information, and probably the biggest advantage, they don't change from year to year. So it does make a good indicator. There are some other factors that these indices do not take into account, such as field size, having to farm around terraces or creeks, rocks. So there are a number of other elements that do affect the desirability of a particular piece of land, but certainly crop index numbers are a good starting point.
Okay, a question for Kevin came in here is, how should perennial crops like alfalfa or some type of trees or fruit crops that might be established on the land be accounted for in lease agreements?
Well, in the case of alfalfa, we realistically treat alfalfa just like any of our other grain crops in Kansas. If it's a crop share lease, we determine the equitable crop share based on this contributions approach. If it's a cash lease, we're going to take the approach very similar to what we would do with crops, but we would annualize the costs. I will have to just be honest and say my experience with the, you know, tree crops, I've never dealt with those. I think you could use a similar approach, but you need to make sure you annualize all your costs. But I just have no experience in working with them, and I'm not sure if Ray or William does either. But my gut feel is we could use a similar approach, but you would have to annualize your costs.
Certainly adjusting for year-to-year variations in production and price would seem to me no different than for annual crops. Certainly the same principles could be used.
Okay, another kind of a general question. I'm not sure who this would necessarily be best directed to, but the questioner is asking, with a rent plus bonus sort of model, are there provisions to reduce rents if gross revenue is lower than the base level?
Well, this really goes back to the question whether the base rent is also a minimum rent. And most of those types of leases that I'm familiar with, the base rent has been a minimum rent as well. And so there is no adjustment if gross would indicate a rent below the base. But that is still a matter between the tenant and the landlord. The higher that base rent is, the less likely that should be as an absolute minimum rent. So certainly, in theory, there's no reason why the bonus couldn't be negative in a year that the numbers came out that way.
Okay. Another question sort of generally directed to you guys as a group is what rental arrangements would you recommend such that the tenant farmer can employ sustainable or you know, biologically healthy practices like crop rotation or increasing tilth or organic matter in the soil on the farmland? So an arrangement or a lease agreement that would accommodate those types of investments by the tenant farmer.
Well, one thing you could do is obviously you make sure you're willing to offer longer term leases. If I'm a tenant, I have the incentive to make sure I'm doing what's right from a stewardship standpoint if I know that I'll have that land for 3, 4, 5 years down the road. But I remind people that a longer-term lease, maybe a 5-year lease, does not mean the rental rate is set for each year of 5 years, unless maybe we're doing, like William has said, is some kind of flexible rent. So one would be to be willing to offer to your tenant something that's a little bit longer-term than just annual leases. The other thing I would argue is that crop share leases, if we're sharing some of those inputs, naturally leads to the incentive for both parties to typically do what's best optimally. And then finally, I would argue that most of the tenants I've dealt with, to the extent that many of these sustainable biological practices are economically optimal, and I think many cases they are, I think that they are already trying to incorporate those. I mean, I think many of our producers are going to do what's best for the land because what's best for the land tends to also be the most economical.
Okay. Well, thank you for those comments. Another question here for Ray. I was wondering, how would a pasture or cropland lease or both, if they're combined in some situations like you described, how would hunting rights be accounted for in that? Have you seen people that have worked to develop lease arrangements around that dimension of the transaction?
Yes, I have, and I'll answer it first, but I might also let one of these other guys answer it. It's merely a case of clear communication. Frequently, it's assumed that because you've got a pasture lease or even a crop lease that you're legal or eligible to go out there and hunt. Because hunting leases are becoming quite valuable right now, some of the landowners are saying, no, you have the right to grow a crop or you have the right to put your livestock out there, but you do not have a right to hunt my deer or my pheasant. And so I think it's merely a case of clear communication, and we are finding that there is a increased cost associated with hunting leases, and so you might find that you're paying a certain amount, $20 per acre for grazing rights, and another $5 or $10 an acre for hunting rights. And I'll let William answer that also, since he's dealt with that a little.
Well, we have tried to measure the market for hunting rights, and
it's really a separate issue from the grazing rights as such, and I guess you have to have a clear understanding of who has priority over the use of the land and make sure there aren't any conflicts between the grazers and the hunters.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for your comments and insights on land leases. We've had a number of good questions come in, and we very much appreciate your responses to those. But in the interest of trying to keep this within the 90-minute time frame we set out to do, we will now move to close our presentations for today. Just one last plug here. If you're not currently a member of the AAEA or the Extension Section, we certainly invite you to join by following the URLs on your screen. I personally have found both the Association and the Extension Section to be of great benefit to my personal career, and I know many of my colleagues across the country feel similar. If you have any suggestions or comments regarding today's webinar topic or topics that you would like to see us share with you in the future, we invite you to share those with us in the chat window. In addition, if you have any other feedback you'd like to provide, we certainly would welcome that as well by the chat window, or you can contact one of the members of the Extension Section leadership listed on the AAEA website. The speaker slides and access to the recordings of this webinar will both be made available on the Extension Section website as well as at the Ag and Uncertain Times webpage. I want to close by again thanking today's speakers and the Ag and Uncertain Times team for their excellent assistance and the presentations on land leases. I also want to thank all those folks that have helped make this possible in terms of the technology and preparation for the event, and especially the participants in today's webinar. We sincerely hope that all of you find today's content of value in your work, and we hope to see you again in one of our upcoming webinar programs. Until then, we wish you success in attempting to meet the challenges of today's agriculture. We will post a web link here that contains all of the URLs that have been mentioned in today's presentations for your download. And thank you again for your participation. For the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association Extension Section, I'm John Hewlett.